you're very welcome along to another episode of the Greg Hughes Podcast. Things can only get better. Well, in the early 90s, those five words weren't just a lyric, they were a global anthem that defined an era of optimism. Behind the iconic sound was a voice from the Northwest that took the world by storm. Today I'm sitting down with the frontman of D-Ream, Peter Connor, for a conversation that goes far beyond the platinum records. We're tracing a life story that began in the Nazareth House mother and baby home in Belfast and led to an upbringing in the heart of Derry during the Troubles. Peter opens up about the powerful journey of his adoption, the decades-long search that recently led him to meet his biological father, and his incredible discovery of a famous musical half-brother. As he turns 60 and puts his life story to paper for a new autobiography, we discuss why he chose to leave the London lights behind to find peace and a forever home overlooking Lough Swilly in County Donegal. Peter, thank you very much for joining us on the podcast. How are you?
Thanks, Greg, for having us. Really good. It's very interesting times for me. So it seems to have taken on a momentum, this life story of mine.
And in sharing it, what's the aim or what are you getting from it, if you know what I mean? I don't mean what are you getting from it in a nasty way, but just...
No, I mean, look, I'm not going to hide the fact. I've got an autobiography coming out, and it's coming out next year, around about the anniversary of... I'll just say this, on the anniversary of the last time I think the country felt good about itself, if that makes any sense. So I'm doing that, and I found a publisher, and I've been working on a book for nearly 2 years now. And in the process of doing that, I got the ending was going to be sort of a Glastonbury, or could have been just left at Labour in 97, but I got this very weird communication from a sister-in-law who pointed that out to me, that she'd found what she thought was my natural father online, because hitherto I'd been led to believe his name was Dusky. And as it turns out, his real name is Hannah. So that explained why we could never get hold of him. And so I went and found the man, and I've since kind of put the final piece of the jigsaw in place. And I was we put an album out just recently. And in the course of that, I was telling people a little bit about that, and then so people would ask a bit more, and the next thing I know, I'm explaining it to the BBC in some detail, and now yourself, and we've been talking to everyone about it. Sheffield, BBC Northern Ireland. It's really it's lovely to see people are interested in that, and not things going to get better for a change.
Yeah, but it's, I suppose it's relatable, and I think a particular part of the story that's relatable is your beginnings, born in a mother and baby home in Belfast. There's actually many people from across the Northwest. Was it always clear to you in your childhood that you were adopted?
Yes. My adopted mum, Monica McDowell, her maiden name was, married an Englishman, Leslie Herbert Cunner. He's an ex-serviceman. He served on Ark Royal. He was a Royal Navy boy. And he was stationed in Ireland, and they married. And luckily I got them, because I must have been very young, 3 or 4. And there's a song, I forget what artist it is, it's a country song called I'm Nobody's Child. I'm Nobody's Child.
No mama's hugs, no daddy's
smile. No mother's kisses, no mommy's smile. Nobody loves me, I'm nobody's child. Now, I heard that long before she told me. She says, son, you know I'm not your real mum. And I was very young. And it was a lot to process. But it was interesting that September when I went to school, so I must have been 5, when the kids on the playground, being the kids what they were like then, there was lots of bullying back in the 70s. And they just said, you don't look like your mum, Connor. Does that mean you're a B-starred? And I used to go, yeah, and? Your point is? Wow. And so they get nowhere to go. You know when you stand up to a bully?
Yeah,
they've got nowhere to go.
I mean, that's some resilience and some response at that age, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I don't know. It's always been like that. Just if you stay honest with people. I didn't take it as offense, because I'd already kind of got, I was pre-warned almost by my mom. So she said, yeah, when you go to the playground, if they ask you ever why you don't look like your brother and sisters, I had an adopted brother and an adopted sister, then you'll know why. And the thing is, what's really sad about it is later on, I had friends. I was with a drummer. I won't mention his name on radio. And I also had a family-in-law, godfather to my children, who found out later in life. In one instance, one of the guys was 23. And it's all to do with they went to get green cards to go to the States, both of them. And they went and saw their lines. And it just confused the bejesus out of them. They were going, what's going on here? And then they had to confront their parents. And then the parents had to say, well, we lied to you. I'm sorry. Mm. Can you imagine? I mean, someone's just pulled the rug from underneath them. And so I felt grateful that I knew from a very early age.
I don't want to pry, but what are you aware what your mother's, the woman that raised you, your mother's motivation was for telling you so young? Because you talked about going back to a time when Ireland was different or whatever, but that was a time too where, you know, the carpet had an awful lot of stuff underneath it, right? So she didn't to. So she did.
From what I recall, she was given the options. The social workers of the time would have mentioned it in their experience. They may have offered the idea to her. And obviously, some adopted parents want to bring up the child as their own, and that's the end of that. And they don't want to have any question marks over it. But for some reason, my mum Monica chose to tell me. And she told Brendan, she told Leslie Ann, and I think it just cleared the air between us. There was an honesty and a trust and going forward. And I didn't want them not to be my parents. You know, I said to them immediately, well, mum, you and dad, meaning adopted, you're my real parents. You know, you wanted me. They didn't.
Yeah.
So it does dig up a lot of stuff, even for a four or five-year-old.
It's astonishing. It's an astonishing self-awareness, I think, from that age. It's brilliant. So in those years then, was there a want in you? Was there a pull? Was there something missing, or did you feel whole?
I think there was definitely something missing. There's always that little question mark in the back of my head. Now, being a kid, you do things like, I hope I'm royalty. I hope they come and find me. You know,
not a prince. Not a fantastic week to say that, but yeah, I get where you're coming from.
Oh yeah, I'm not that royalty. Okay, they're turning me into a bloody Republican.
I know.
Yeah. But
maybe Monaco or something.
No, I'm thinking of Prince Charming. None of this stuff that's going on. So, I was just thinking, like, you know, like fantasy world, like, you know, Snow White and all the rest of it. But and then the other one was I kind of parked at it. I think they died in a car crash, or they could have been. Yeah. What do you call them? Marine biologists. And they were eaten by a shark. It was just stuff that I sort of dealt with it, you know, and I never really revisited it until just before Doreen was breaking through in 1991. I got this. I was living in London. My folks were back in Ireland. Excuse me. Got that little lurgy that's going around.
Yeah.
And I got this call from my mum. And she says, son, there's a letter here from you. I went, all right. She says, I've been waiting for this letter addressed to you all of your life. And I was going, all right, cryptic. But I got a sense of what she meant. I kind of drew the line between being told I was adopted and then this letter. So I got her to open it over the phone. And what was in the letter was an outpouring of emotion. You could hear the trauma in my natural mother's voice. She only wanted to make contact with me. And she just wanted a photograph and to know I was okay. It was really very touching. And I said to Mum, well, what do you want to do? I said, well, let's go and meet them. And she said, okay. And I said, well, why don't you and Dad come up and drive me up and we'll all go meet them together. So I kept it all, because you know how people can fill in the blanks.
Mm.
And that was probably one of the best things. They got on like a house on fire. And I got up the road to a place called Strabane, which is only about 40 minutes from Derry where I was reared up. And I got to meet Anne. I walked through her door and she said, my door will always be open to you. And I said, that's great, Anne. Put the kettle on. So we sat down and she started telling me basically who I was, why I smoked other people's cigarettes, why I like spicy food. And, you know, it was like someone, like a tarot reader, but on steroids. It's amazing.
Les and Monica must be amazing, confident people, are they? Or did they always just want the best for you? Because I have done a number of interviews in this space. It seems very rare where they sort of have that, you know, this is who you are, this is that person, you know, and to go with you, to bring you, to be part of that, to not feel threatened by it. You know, maybe I'm not framing them correctly, but that's really how they're coming across.
I couldn't have done better. I mean, when I showed an aptitude for playing guitar, this is 1978, I would have been about 12. That year, Dad bought me a Fender Mustang, that's Kurt Cobain's guitar, okay, and a Fender Twin Reverb. Now, that's the equivalent of 2 months' wages back then. So he saw something in me, they believed in me, and I got this brilliant gift. I mean, I must have been the only kid in, you know, 300 miles with something like this. So I spent time then, you know, learning my chops and all of that before I ended up getting into bands and what have you. So, I keep thinking, and now that I've met Patrick, my natural father, he's not like this at all, but it could have gone the other way. I could have had a fella who came home from the pub and beat up on me and mum, and I didn't have that. I had the complete opposite, very loving environment.
How important was the story as to your birth parents, how your mother ended up in a mother and baby's home, the decision for you to be put up for adoption? Are you the type that needed all those questions answered to get all of those threads tied up?
Well, to be honest, I think that just appeared in the natural part of conversations that went on for a few years. I didn't have a list of questions to ask her when I sat down. It sort of evolved really naturally. And the one thing I did find out about Anne, my natural mother, she was the lead singer in a show band in the 50s in Ireland called the Marine Show Band.
Right.
And my natural father, she said, one of the other things she said to me when she first met me is, "You're his spit, you're Patrick's son." I was going, okay. And that's a real confirmation by her, for her own mind as much as mine. And she went, he was only 19. It was obviously a brief affair in the band because he left then to move to England within a year, I think. And she was taken out of the band and shuffled away to the place that they hid all of the poor girls back then with me, carrying me. And Patrick went on to basically start a solo career over in the Midlands. He worked in Manchester and in Sheffield, basically as a song and dance man. He was like a Tom O'Connor type. He had a band in the pit. He had the dancing girls. He had the big flare collars on.
Okay.
The same ones I wore in the 90s.
Yeah.
I kid you, I have pictures of him dressed like me.
Astonishing, isn't it, really?
They say nurture and nature. I don't know what that is.
Well, do you know what? I had nature and nurture going over in my head as I was listening to you intently, and I think this is almost like a blind experiment. You've got the nature of, you know, what was born into you, but then you had this fantastic nurture to bring it through. So you are proof of both.
Greg, in all honesty, having looked at it, I think we're 90% cast. We're like a DNA mold, and we come out, and so much of this is in the ancestry, coming down the ages through your fingers, through your voice, the tone of your voice, the smell of your skin. That's all been pre-programmed. Yeah. And I, in my own opinion, I think it's like 10% nurture. And I had a great nurturing environment, don't get me wrong, but at the minute, that's where my head's at, and I won't be shifted from that point.
So the musical, obviously the musical spark came early. How big of an influence was your Derry surroundings sort of in terms of growing, you know, finding who you are artistically? Or
Derry's, if you come to Derry now, it is kick ass. Mm. That's the best way I can put it. It's got so much talent. It's a party town. It's always had that sort of suppressed joy, and now it's just you can go out and see six bands in a night. It's like Grafton Street used to be back in the 80s, and it's wonderful. The boys and girls and all the incomers and tourists are having a great time. And for me, back in the 80s, it was a tougher time because we were under the shadow of the Troubles. Mm. We were still under the shadow of a nuclear war, and if you remember.
That's it.
But
yeah.
We still played and had fun with as best we could, you know. But a lot of the venues we were in, my first band, we were doing a gig at the Castle Bar, and the Casbah, it was called, and it was blown up 2 weeks before we were supposed to play. And so we just found another venue, that's all. But you sort of just deal with it, you know. Right. But I think I remember my grand saying to me, "Why do you want to be a musician?" I was going, well, it's what I did. She goes, ah, but they're two to the penny. I had no choice.
Yeah. And Camille, I don't like to read between the lines, but that period of time, the formation and Dream becoming what it became, and that song, of course, Things Can Only Get Better. Number one, you know, that's a small group of people can say that. How important is that period of your life to you at your age now?
No, I, looking back in it, and I've had a couple of years to really get into. It's a funny thing writing a book compared to writing a song. A song, you've got to have four lines to get across a big idea, and a book's like you can have 400 lines to get across one idea. And for me, I thought that fame would fix in me mm-hmm. the missing piece that I had. I thought that's what I want, and I was single-mindedly focused on that. But it wasn't. And I think that yearning that we have is part of the human spirit. I think part of it's spiritual. I think it's connection with people when we miss that. And it comes down to the important stuff. It's friends, the family, and love. And if we haven't got those in abundance, then I think we wither and die. And I thought the adulation, it felt like it worked for a bit, but then after a while it felt hollow. And then later on, now that I've found Patrick, it's bizarre because it just feels... I'm in some levels I'm at peace like I've never been before. I understand myself better, and I put the final piece of the jigsaw in place of this question mark that's been kind of around me my whole life. So, no, it's look, I've had the great experience, and if you know mother and baby homes, I'm a rarity in that environment. So I don't want to take away in any way from the pain that a lot of people have suffered. I've just got this story that's mine. And,
well, you can only live your own truth and live your own story, can't you?
Yeah,
I mean, you can have empathy and understanding, but you can only, if it hasn't started already, you're going to hear this word an awful lot, especially as it comes close to publishing time, cathartic, right? It's the default question you're going to get all of the time. Yeah. But you've already sort of talked to the fact that you've worked through a lot of stuff in this process, so I suppose the answer is inevitable.
Yeah. And it's like, I'm 60 this August, so I'm still 59. I have to remind myself. And we're going to throw one hell of a party in Derry.
Brilliant.
In Derry, they're putting a mural of me up on the gable end of the row of houses I grew up in Clarendon Street in the town centre. Someone bought my house, my family home, and Eileen McLaughlin. She's an artist herself. And when the solicitors decided to paint the gable end of the house, now I'm talking three-story high house, Edwardian, you know, or even Georgian probably, it was a listed building. So they had to wait a year to get the permission. And now the guy that's done the Derry Girls mural is up there in the scaffolding putting my bonds on the side of this thing. And we're going to launch a party for my 60th in up the Bishopsgate. Going to have the band over, and we're going to celebrate all the friends and family, because I've got a song on the last album called Many Hands, and it celebrates that, about that we're only here by the good grace of others. And that's what the song talks about, how many hands have raised you, praised you, and lifted you up so that you can see. So that's the idea. So
I'm fascinated to know what depiction of you is being used then. Is it?
I'll have to send you a copy of it. Can I drop it into the chat or something?
Yeah, you sure? Like, because...
How do I do that?
I don't know.
Oh, this chat's here. If I open that and I pull one of these photographs, let me see if I can find it. Well, it's me looking forlorn off the second album. This is her artwork.
Oh, wow. Right, okay.
Yes,
that's
wow.
Fantastic. Yeah,
You can see the man there for scale.
Yeah.
And now, it's bonkers. Since I've come back to Derry, I moved back home here in 2019. Just, I've been in London 40 years.
Yeah.
I had the kids. I had the T-shirt. I had several T-shirts. And I came home. And you see tourists now walking around Derry. And what they're doing is, they're looking at all the sectarian murals, and then they go into the non-sectarian ones where it's just like John Hume or the Derry Girls or the Undertones, and it's all there. And there's like, and it's funny because back in the day, like, it was just where we grew up. There was riots held. And
well, you see, this is the and just by pure coincidence, 2 days ago we were actually chatting to Lisa McGee, and. We kind of, some of this conversation is quite similar. I think in a way, you know, people like yourself, who were sort of like those shards of light in a very dark time, shine brighter, sort of almost, if you know what I mean. Because when you're looking at things to remember, Derry is so much more, and the whole of Northern Ireland is so much more than
Thank
the
you.
Troubles.
Yes, it is.
And you know, I think
I'm so proud of so proud of my town. If I grew up through the part when it was on its knees. And then I went away to London for 4 years. I was back regularly, sometimes 4 and 5 times a year. And I saw the progress after 97, that Good Friday Agreement. There's kids now who've grown up, they're in their 20s. They did not know all the stuff that we went through. All they've known is peace. And rightly so. I would wish that on everyone from here to Gaza, you know, just to have the peace and to have it in place. So we've been virtually unscathed for a long time now. And you can see the peace dividends paying back. It's become a party town. It's a destination. There's plenty of tourists going on. There's real industry going on here, through crafts, and people are brewing, and people are into organics. And there's lots of stuff going on. People making, like Love Gym making, there's Paul making a club, you know, but gym wear and stuff. And you think of it. Given the chance, this is what people do.
Opportunity, isn't it? Yeah,
they thrive.
And without, there's still elements of it that we have to remove. But without that drag of pick a side, you must do this. This is your future. You know, indoctrination. Yeah. As I say, it still happens, but we're seeing it less and less now.
Less and less, because the generations are getting to a point now where, you know, I became what they call politically homeless. Then I became North partisan. I can hold what you people in parties would call conflicting views, and they don't conflict in my mind. I just think that makes sense to me, and I think that's okay. But I'm struck by what Dolly Parton said. She says, "Son, I'm just a singer," and that'll do for me. You know what I'm saying?
Just before we move on, that time with Doreem, you talked about, you know, on reflection, you know, what makes you whole. Really, just to sort of paraphrase it. Was it hard to sort of know who was your friend, who wasn't your friend, who was on your coattails for the wrong reasons? Party drugs, all that kind of stuff. I mean, you were just you were cool as hell as well too. You know, some of those poses of yours are iconic. You know, it's true. As a young lad as well, you know, what was it? Were you pulled all over the place? Did you fall foul of the addiction? Drugs
and all
that
stuff? I've ticked all the boxes everyone can imagine, right? You know, I've been equally cool and equally stupid. And that's okay, because, like, I've made my peace with it now. I think in the time it was just chaos. It was organized chaos. We were those ducks that are, like, gliding, you know, and underneath we were pedaling like mad, you know. But I wouldn't change it for the world. It's what I did. It's always what I wanted to do. And having got there, it got to a point where it wasn't doing, as I said, it wasn't working. I ended up in recovery, chartered Nightingale, and got myself clean. And then I just walked away from the business. It's just that someone said to me, if you're going to get a haircut, then hang around the barbers.
Yeah.
Right. So I just thought I'll leave my job at the barbers now. And I just changed my social group, and I changed the pressures of fame. And I literally walked my dog around Wormwood Scrubs for about 5 years. I met King Pearly Jim, the Pearly King, and his wife, Jane, the Pearly Queen. And I just sort of just lived. And then I got married, and then I had children, and I stayed with that for a long time. And I just got on with normal living. You know, when you say normal, it's normal. It's outside the trappings of fame or the needs or the demands of it. Because at one point I couldn't go down the high street without kids dragging me into a shop to buy them ice cream. You know, it was just full on.
I can't remember who I was talking to. It'll come to me in a moment. But it's actually quite a similar story to this other person, in that are you on the fringes, right? So whereby you can have your family life, but you also have the contacts or the talent or the numbers to sort of perform or to sort of scratch that artistic itch, right? But still you can go back then to normality.
The best phrase I heard was lifestyle without the hassle.
Well, there you go, yeah.
We're on the festival circuit. Just incidentally, I was looking at our tour dates here today, for what it's worth. If anyone's remotely interested, we're going to be doing Replay in the Park at South Inch Park in Perth in Scotland on August 16th. So there you go.
Do you love it?
Say again?
Do you love it performing?
Oh, you see, this
now.
Is the thing. I hate traveling. I hate hotel rooms. I'm done. I'm so done. Yeah. And you get on stage and it's that free drugs, adrenaline. And then you go in and then people are up for a, they're up. I'm not going to curse on radio. They're up for a good time, an effing good time. Mm. And then you sort of, you get to do this mad thing and you finish on your big song and everyone's just in the happy zone. And I walk off the stage and I go, that's why.
Do you do the gigs whereby there's a number of sort of acts from that time period? Because
that's right. We did quite a bit of 90s
festivals. I really
want
to
yeah,
go to yeah. one of those.
Oh, they're fabulous. Yeah. Yeah.
And everyone looks great still. You know, everyone looks fantastic.
Well, depending how much you've got to drink, they all look fantastic.
No, but if you look at people like Rick Ashley, right? He looks fantastic.
Yeah, he's a real talent.
And he's,
yeah.
he's releasing new music. He's up there fully authentic on the biggest stages, you know.
We're there with people like the Happy Mondays, and then we're also with people like Sonique and 911 and A1, whose singles I worked on, and at Chesney Hawks we see often. It's wonderful, you know. Yeah. Chesney we hang out a bit with because we get on really well.
He seems really nice. I've heard him on a couple of podcasts, and he seems to have the best of it. He's still bloody handsome.
I was a bit jealous at the amount of girls that were throwing themselves.
I'm not surprised. Brian Cox, right, just one random question, because I think everyone in life has someone where you ask someone a question and you wish they didn't ask because they go on about things forever, and that man's so bloody intelligent. Was he a fascinating character back then, or pedantic, or what?
So Brian, I keep saying, I'll say it to the day I die, I take some credit for his career insofar as when we were on our tour coach, and you said we were with us for about 3.5 years, when we were on our tour coach, he used to explain to us really, really complicated ideas. And I wouldn't say I'm the sharpest pin in the box. I'm not stupid. You know, I'm sort of B grade A, O level. But he sort of learned how to – I used to say, you know, I think we helped you because you learned to say really complicated things to stupid people like me. And, one day he sort of cracked. He says, you know what, Pete, I'll give that to you.
Yeah. So you were the original explain it to me like I'm a five-year-old, and he just adopted that for the rest of
his life. Yeah,
because
he was dealing with us. And let me tell you, we were five-year-olds. Absolutely. We're just like school kids, let loose.
Yeah.
And he'd come off the tour coach. He'd have a book. Well, I was working on Vincent Cronin's Napoleon. Don't make of that what you will. Levain, our backing singer, come up, she had a copy of OK magazine. And Brian would have a book which is about yay thick, which to me would read the same if you started at the back, yes. Right? So that's just, it was life on the road with Doreen, you know.
If I've got the timelines right, the contact from your birth mom came just as you were starting to shoot,
that's right?
1990, 91,
yeah.
That was fine. The timing was fine. You didn't get caught up. Oh well, this is only happening now because you know. Now she didn't know you were about to hit the big time, right?
No,
but you that never bothered you. The time wasn't an issue. It just was the way it was.
There's never a good time for any of these things, is there? I mean, you know, people talk about having children, and there's never a good time. It's always quite hard. You know, it's life. Life is life, isn't it? So yeah. I was just dealing with it. It was funny because when the sun turned up on her doorstep, she said, Peter, these people have been outside all day. I says, I'll tell you what, Anne, go out and ask them if they want to speak to you. Ask them for 10 grand. And she got on the phone to me an hour later and she said, it worked, you know, they're gone.
Oh, my God, yeah. And so, but then there's 3 decades effectively, your whole life, you know, relationships, children, as you've mentioned, moves and all of that type of stuff. You kind of think, really, don't you, that far on, you know where you're at. You know, you know your family circle, you know your friends, right? You kind of have whittled it down to a small group. And then...
yeah.
How did it come about then that you discovered who your dad was, your birth father was, sorry. No disrespect
really
to your...
I ended up standing at their gravestone asking for permission. I know it's bonkers, but things we do. I was about to go on tour in Australia, and I'll tell you, Snap were headlining, then there was us, D-Ream, and then there was CC Peniston. It was going to be great. We'd 4 stadiums lined up. It took about 8 months to put together. And just a week before we were due to leave, and we'd done all the immigration forms, all the solicitors signed up and had to tell about addresses and all the details they require for you to go over there. The guy said he's pulling the plug, and he'd sold something like 40% of the tickets. So I'm just sitting there looking at this text in one hand, and the other side, there's the phone's ringing, and it's my half-sister, Philippa. And I just put this other thing down, and I was like, well, this is life. Who cares? It's a tour. This is something. So I ended up calling her. She came to me because the first number I was given was Patrick's. Now, Patrick's stage name, what Anne told me when I met her, Patrick's name was Patrick Dusky. That was a misnomer, a red herring, because his name, real name is Patrick Hannah. So when my sister-in-law found this out, she started sleuthing around on the internet, and then she ended up handing me a whole load of evidence that she'd gathered about this man she discovered was called Hannah. Now, that opened up a whole can of worms, because it turns out Patrick was married twice after he'd been with my mum in the band, and he'd had two kids by his first marriage and one kid by the second. The first two children are Stuart and Jackie. Stuart is a man called Stuart Zender. He's the bass player with Jamiroquai.
Now, that's crazy, right? That the two of you...
Yeah. Crazy.
That's just bizarre.
Nuts. But, of course, it's perfectly... Of course it is.
Yes, but right? To find both of you to find yourselves into two massive bands. I mean, the fact that maybe you both be musicians, talented, artistic.
That's
but
it.
But two and, big bands, you could have been on one of these concerts.
His sister had the same capability. It's just that she ended up having children, what have you. But she's really good. Jackie's got her own band. And then Philippa, as it turns out, is a massive on the kind of non-denominational worship scene. It's a world I've just found out about. But she'll go and play South Africa, and she's got 100,000 believers in a stadium singing her songs. And I'm like, oh, my God. As I said to you about the DNA being 90%, it's just bonkers. So I found out all of this stuff. But so I texted Stuart. I got tumbleweed. I texted Patrick. I got bloody crickets. And then, so finally, of course, the girls, right? They're bang on it. Hello, who are you? What exactly is the nature of your inquiry? Blah, blah, blah. The next thing I know, I'm calling her. And we're sort of exchanging photos. You know, like, you look like Stuart. Your daughter looks like Stuart's daughter. The Melanie Blatt's daughter. And it's like, oh, okay, hang on a minute. And it's all beginning to make sense. And then she says, do you know, I, just for fun, a couple of years back, I did Ancestry DNA with my dad. And by the way, I'm not bloody employed by Ancestry DNA. I've no interest. I'll just say, from now, I'm going to just say one of those DNA companies.
Until such time as they sign a bloody deal. But yeah, go on.
Yeah, come on. Listen, I'm waiting, guys. I need that swimming pool. And so it's like, okay. So I said, I'll have a go. And I did. And we waited about, so they say 8 weeks, but it came in six, and it was a proper match with Patrick, and she's got a quarter match of me. So I was straight away, I threw this over to her.
So because everything's speculation, is it that they look familiar, blood, all that kind of stuff, right? But then there's a piece of paper, metaphorically speaking or literally, that states, oh, this man, this Patrick Hannah is your dad. Was that
Oh, it was fabulous.
Boom moment.
A boom moment. Absolutely. Mind was blown. And I was sitting there. I was so full of, I don't know, like joy and surprise. And also, you said cathartic. It just felt completion. Like that final piece of the jigsaw got placed in.
In relation to that, sorry to cut across you, but I'm fascinated by it. Did you realize a piece was missing? Or in that moment, did you realize a piece was missing, if you know what I'm saying? Like, in other words, did you feel whole until that moment and then you realized, do you know what?
No, I didn't. That's probably, I think, the biggest part of the driver in me is that, whatever, that yearning. And then sort of any question marks I had kind of just fell into place. You know, as you said, the cathartic thing. And working on the books, like it's like authoring, what's the word for it? You're also almost making sense of yourself, you know, in this thing. And I've got a thing called a manuscript. It's 158,000 words long, covers, you know, the four decades, the interesting decades of my life, and in some detail. But out of that, the book won't be more than 75,000. So you've got to have this kind of condensed, almost like a good wine brought down to a reduction. And I was sort of sitting on this thing, and I had to rewrite the ending because I was just going to finish on. The book talks a lot about identity, who we think we are, where we come from, and what's in a name. I talked about what's in a name because they gave me the name Peter Cunha, and I've grown into that name, and that's the name we call you, the name you respond to. And when you find out that you're not actually that name, that you could have been my dad's name, he wanted to call me Herbert Arrowsmith, or I could have been Peter Hanna had I been born to Patrick. It starts to bring up a lot of things, but I'm quite happy using the name they give me.
You obviously, it's very, you can make decisions about, you know, opening these doors and walking through them, and because you're responsible for yourself, but you've other people around you now. In fact, I think your daughter went to the initial meeting with your father. How did you feel responsible for what this means to people in my life that I'm pursuing this? It sounds to me like you've been blessed with very supportive people around you.
Yeah,
pretty much all of your life. But
I am very, very lucky man. But I also I tend to see the best in everybody, and I try and I can be, you know, I can be awkward sometimes and stuff. But I tend to want to be a mediator between people. And even though my daughters have got their own issues with me leaving their mum back in the, I didn't leave it. We just didn't work out in 2008. I was coming through Manchester, and it just so happens my youngest, Madeline, kind of is studying dance, contemporary dance at Manchester University. And I said, look, I'm passing through. Do you want to come up and meet this man? It's your grandfather. And much to my surprise, she said, yes. So there we were, traveling up in the hire car, going over the Pennines on a beautiful day. And if you've ever been over the Pennines, it's, you know, I think one of the national treasures of the country. We got up to Barnsley, where he's
Barnsley.
Living.
Yep.
Barnsley. I can't do it. My Barnsley.
We can cut that out. Go on. We've got four minutes of you trying to find a picture to cut out. But anyway, carry on.
Well, I've got a picture there of ourselves with Stuart and everyone. But so we went up and we had this fantastic evening where his lovely wife, Sandra, put this spread on it. And when I mean spread, it was like a time machine, because it was like a 1970s salad with, you know, undressed salad with an egg on top. Oh, wow. And then the prawn cocktail. And the chicken and the boiled potato. And it was like, oh, God, this is so good. And we had Angel Delight, you know, the whole thing.
My God.
And we were sitting there pouring. I made him an album. Because I've been working on the book, I was able to compile everything from my mum and dad and my dad's time in the Navy, my mum working in the factories here in Derry. And I went through bits and pieces of Derry and the Troubles, and then my indie band, going to college, some of my girlfriends, and getting into college, and then the early days of Dream, and then the height of Dream, and then getting married and having children. And I poured it all in there. And so we sat, like, it's almost like, the brainstorming him into my life, you know, within the few hours that we had. And he got his, as I said, he got his stuff out. And then that's where I saw he had the flares on, and he had the big colors. And,
unbelievable.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. He was aware of Dream, though, would he? He would have been.
I think so.
He had to have been.
In my heart of hearts, I thought, you know, look, someone's going to come forward, right? You know, surely.
Yeah.
It's just pretty obvious. But, you know, that's not the way life works.
No, it was fleeting too, wasn't it? I mean, he would have had to have really,
focused,
to make the connections,
yeah,
it would have been borderline impossible.
It bears the question, do you have to go to D-Ream level or Elton John level? At which stage should they bring them on? But I just, once I had this evidence that Teresa gave me, I and my mum and dad had passed on, and it was about 6 months into that I thought, you know what, if I leave this any longer, I don't know if I'll be able to see him or whatever. And it turns out he's 79 now. He's still in fairly good health, even having had a stroke there, I think, about a year ago. But they've since come down to my shows.
Oh, wow.
In fact, you got to see this. This is a great photograph, if I can drop this onto the timeline. So there's Patrick with his T-shirt on. Things can only get better. Now you found us. That's the tagline.
Oh, wow.
And on the back, it says Dad. So everyone's job was on the back. I know, it's just brilliant.
It is, I thought it was a bit cheap.
And then, hang on, not that one.
He looks great. He looks fantastic.
Oh, man. Yeah. So blown away with this guy. And the thing is, when I gave him a hug, it was apparent to me, you know, he's the same sort of height as me, same strength. It was so deep that the hug that we had, I just thought, It's like hugging yourself. It's really odd. And yeah, can I see that there? Patrick Fuller, but
you know, when you were, whenever you were going into a doctor's surgery or a GP or whatever it's called, right? You know, what's your family history? This is a big problem for people who are adopted, because the first question is, what's your family?
What's your family? Is there any heart issues? Yeah. Has there been any cancer?
Was that a problem?
I couldn't answer it.
Yeah.
So I just had to just trust that I was going to do my own thing, you know? And so.
That's a great picture.
Yes. Yeah, did you really see the second one?
Yeah, I have it now.
From left to right there, that's Sandra, his wife, myself in the middle there. And to my left, that's your right, immediately is Philippa. Philippa Hannah is the gospel singer. Be like, that's my little niece, Ozma, and Philippa's half-sister, Alex, and Philippa's husband, Joel.
Wonderful.
And he tour manages her and plays drums and when they do a lot of
It's so encouraging that things have worked out so nicely for you. Because, I mean, this doesn't, obviously, in life, there's ups and downs, and you sort of reference them before, and there's stuff you go through, right? But overall, it's really worked nice for you, I think.
If I kept this to myself, I would be in. And there's no way this story has to be told. It just has to be. Because I thought about this. And it's you couldn't make this up.
Yeah.
You could not make this up. Life is stranger than fiction.
There's a bang of Phil Coulter off you now. Derry, Lough Swilly. You're settled now on the in Farn, aren't you? What's that like for you?
It's beautiful. I always say I'm like the filling between two spiritual pieces of toast. and what I mean by that is just about half a mile to the north of me is Buncrana. It's the harbour in which John Newton was kept after his storm, where he repented and then later wrote Amazing Grace. And the other end, towards the Derry end, heading south, is there's a church up there and a massive sacristy, which she's called Fanny Alexander. And she wrote All Things Bright and Beautiful and Once in Royal David City.
Mm. It's astonishing, really, that entire area.
Yeah. And you're talking about Phil produced. Coulter, yeah. the undertones, Diana, Nadine Coyle. It's just, the place is just full of people who love. We love storytelling, Greg. I think that's the main thing about the area. They love a good, and they'll hang on a good story. That's what it's all about, like the bars, if you like, they called it back in the old days. And so that's become a thing that's just in their DNA again. And I think that's why. Naturally, they love getting that out. But yeah. I'm hoping that some of that lovely fresh sea air rubs off on me, you know, and maybe I'll write another thing that's going to get better. That works in the States.
This sounds like it's discrediting everything else you've done career wise, and it's not. But do you feel there's another things can only get better in you? If you get where I'm coming from,
I do. I think that it's. When the label asked me to do that, I think you could probably go on to AI now and have it do that. And I'm not a machine. And so I said to them back, I don't know where that came from. It took me nearly 3 years to put that together. And I'd already done things like You're the Best Thing and Blame It on Me and Shoot Me With Your Love. I'd already
all cracking
hits,
songs, you know.
You know,
it's one of, actually, as you list them, it's hit after hit after hit. You would actually almost, and I'm glad you did for those listening, because you could almost feel that. I always found that with, like, completely separate to you, but Bagatelle, you know, they're one of those bands where you think they only did one song, and then you go to the concert and 15, 16, 17 songs in, you know every one of them, and that's the kind of. That's your story, isn't it? It's far beyond the big one.
Yeah, exactly. And it's so big.
At least, what about poor Chesney Hawkes?
Well, if you heard him live, he's wonderful.
Oh, he's fantastic, and he's doing great stuff. But I mean, he is or arguably your sort of quintessential one hit. But there's so much more to him, and he's super talented and producing great stuff now.
Yeah.
So. It is the final piece in now? I won't take up too much of your time, Peter. It's been lovely chatting to you. Are you the complete man now?
Oh, I don't think we're ever. I think we're all a work in progress, Greg. Yeah. I don't know if you agree. I wouldn't like to say, oh, yes, all done.
Yeah, yeah, I think it's all done, you've given up, haven't you?
Yeah, you have. And life's interesting, and it throws up all sorts of stuff. And my wish now is to just be with my band and spend the next 10, 15 years, God willing, if I get into my mid-70s, just entertaining people. That's a great thing to dip into. And then in between that, we do a lot of traveling. You know, I have all the possessions a man could wish for. I don't need anything material anymore. I just want time with friends and family. And I want to go and see the world a bit, because believe it or not, when you're traveling to do all the gigs like in Australia and America, you don't see it.
No, of course. I'm agreeing with you as if I know on my last tour, right? But I do. I think we all can relate to that there. And are you going to try and get the book out in your 60th, on your 60th? Because obviously with what's going on in Derry, the mural. No,
it's more clever than that.
Right, okay, go on.
I said in 2027, May 27 is the 30th anniversary of when I thought the last time this country felt like a sea change. And I mean that, like, I don't care what party it is. Back then it was Labour. But I just sort of hearkening back to that, and I think that that's important to put it out as an anniversary for that, because first of all, it gets publishers' attention, it'll get people's attention, but the book is not about Labour. The book is about my adoption story and the search for identity. And along the way, I had a hit record.
Yeah. Interesting the way you've put it, but it's going to have a multifaceted appeal. There's going to be people that want to know more about you.
Okay.
It's got the Derry background, it's got the adoption story, and it's got that showbiz story. And I think, too, from speaking to you, there's perhaps an awful lot we can learn. We can all learn off each other. Peter, it's been an absolute pleasure. I'm so pleased with the way things are going for you. I mean, you're blessed that you're in Farn now anyway, and an exciting couple of years ahead. So thank you so very much for chatting us and joining us on the podcast.
Thank you, Greg. Take care, everyone.
And again, a big thank you to Peter for spending some time with us on the Greg Hughes podcast. Now, don't forget, we release a new episode for you every Friday morning at 11 a.m. on the Highland Radio website. We're also releasing it on Spotify and iTunes if you prefer to listen there. If you've got any feedback or any suggestions, you can get in contact with the podcast's researcher and producer. That is, of course, Caroline Orr. And you can contact her via email, Caroline Orr at HighlandRadio.com. But until next time, we'll see you.